30836, balance operating versus door set.
May it please the court, Mr. Tom Zabel will present argument to petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. The Texarkana Court of Appeals in this case, in construing the most widely used model form joint operating agreement, committed an error of great significance to the oil and gas industry in Texas by ruling or construing for the first time an implied 30-day standstill requirement on the commencement of operations proposed under a joint operating agreement. They compounded this error by saying that you couldn't start even a negligible part of the proposed operation until the 30-day election period had transpired. The way it works under the joint operating agreement is you send out a notice proposing the operation, specifying the well location, the estimated cost, and other particulars, and you give the other non-proposing parties 30 days within which to decide whether they want to share in the risk of the operation and the cost, or whether they want to let the other parties do that and give up a multiple of the production that they would be entitled to out of that operation if it's successful. It's undisputed in this case that the non-proposing party had the full opportunity afforded her under the operating agreement to make her election within the 30-day period. What the respondent did in this case is she sat back. The first of the eight wells drilled was drilled in 96, waited 4 years. She never elected to participate within the 30-day period. She let the operation go on at the cost, expense, and risk of the other parties. 4 years later, she comes in and says, oh, you started some part of the operation before the end of the 30-day election period. Therefore, you can't avail yourself of the non-consent provisions in this operating agreement. That flies in the face of industry custom and practice. It's very important in the oil and gas industry that you are able to conduct operations when you need to conduct those for rig availability, favorable markets, and to address lease concerns, lease termination issues, drainage, development issues. You've got to be able to commence the work when the industry dictates through the rigs and everything else. You can't wait necessarily always for the entire notice period to go. Now, what the Court of Appeals did is they said, well, Ms. Dorsett, the respondent would be harmed because we started early. But she wouldn't. Because the Court of Appeals was concerned that you need to, that the information needs to be conveyed to the non-proposing party, and they need to have the opportunity to elect. They had that. In fact, by starting an operation early, you get even more information within which you can consider to make your election. So you benefit from the early commencement of operations. The Court of Appeals acknowledged that there was a benefit from the early start of operations, but then said, well, surely Valence couldn't have intended to confer such a benefit on Ms. Dorsett. Well, what the Court of Appeals needed to consider is all the reasons why Valence would do that. Because of rig availability, the market factors, the lease concerns, and those are all things that this court and appellate courts have commonly taken notice of for decades in oil and gas cases.
Or because they just felt like it.
Pardon?
Or because they just felt like it. Don't you think they have the... Isn't it your position that Valence had the right to do that? Whether there was a good reason or a bad reason.
Yes, Your Honor, that is the position. As long as the party is afforded their 30-day election period, yes, then you can start those operations before that period commences, absolutely, or during that period.
So if notice was served on day one and the spud date was day two, then the working interest owners would have 29 days worth of drilling information.
Absolutely.
As a benefit.
Absolutely.
It's your position.
Absolutely.
In order to make the decision to participate or not participate in the rules.
That's correct.
Is there any harm
there
not
is
allowing
absolutely.
The 30 days to fully run?
I tried to think of every possible harm there could be, and I couldn't come up with any harm. The Court of Appeals, when they construed the provision, they looked at, they basically made three errors when they construed the operating agreement. The first is they looked at a provision that dealt with consenting parties in evaluating the non-consent party. What they said is there's a provision that says that after the 30-day period runs, then the proposing party or operator needs to advise all the consenting parties of who's in and give them an opportunity to take part of the non-consent benefit that the parties who have non-consented have given up. And the Court of Appeals said, well, they wouldn't be afforded that opportunity if you started early. Well, of course they would. they'd be in the same exact position, the consenting parties, that the non-consenting party was in by the early start of operations. They got that much more information on which to base their decision. So the consenting parties are not harmed. They're benefited by the early start of an operation. So the looking to that provision was wrong in the first place to construe the non-consent provision, but then they misconstrued it anyway. Then the other error they made is they looked to the provision that said that in order to be entitled to the benefits of the non-consent provision, actual work must commence within 60 days after expiration of the notice period and must be completed with due diligence. They construed the word within to mean only during that magical 60-day period. But if you look at a couple of the definitions, even in Webster's dictionary, it's before the expiration of, within the fixed limits of, which means any time before expiration of that 60-day period you can start the operation. And more importantly, what all the courts have said is you've got to construe these model forms in where you have a trade or a profession. You've got to construe it in light of the customs and practices in the industry. And the custom and practice in the industry, as demonstrated by the Texoga brief, which represents 90% of the production in Texas, said this is what operators do all the time. They've got to start operations when the factors require it, the rig availability, the marketing factors. So if you construe the word within in its proper context, don't do it in the ordinary natural meaning. You do it in the context in which it's used in the industry. But I submit, even if you go to the ordinary and customary meaning and you look at the definitions in Webster's, you still come back to the fact that as long as you start it before the expiration of the 60-day period following the 30-day notice period, you're fine, whether it be during that 60-day period or before that 60-day period.
So you would assert then that the one absolute in these time periods is that commencement of work on the proposed project has to begin within 90 days after notice.
Absolutely.
That's an absolute.
That's an absolute. And the reason for that provision, the Court of Appeals misconstrued the reason for that provision, and Texoga talks about this in their brief. The reason for that provision, if you look at it, says you've got to commence actual work within the 60 days following the expiration of the notice period and complete it with due diligence. The very purpose of that provision is to keep an operation from being stale. They don't want you to AFE or notice an operation, wait 2 years to do it when all the factors in the world have changed, and then still hold someone to the non-consent provisions. So the provision was put in there to require diligence on the part of the operator, yet the way the Court of Appeals construes it, it makes them delay operations. Say, for example, you have a drilling rig you can get, but you're going to get it on the very first day after the 30-day period. But you need to prepare the location, put in a road that might take 2 weeks. Under the Court of Appeals opinion, you have to have that rig, pay for that rig, starting on the first day after the 30-day period, possibly for a period of 2 weeks while you're preparing a road and the location, because you can't start even the most minimal operation before the end of that 30-day period. So you get to sit back and wait before you can even do anything. And then the most important factor of their opinion was that one of the requirements, there's only five requirements that you have to set forth in the notice. One of those requirements is you have to specify the well location. But yet the Court of Appeals says that surveying your well location could constitute the commencement of operations. So you go out, you're due diligent, you use diligence, you prepare a proper notice, you survey the well location, you put it in your notice, but yet now you've commenced the operation because you've surveyed the well. So you could never have the benefits of the non-consent provisions. So that's what the Court of Appeals opinion does. It's directly contrary to the business activity to be served, which this court addressed in great length in the Lenape decision. It flies right in the face of it. The whole purpose of these provisions is the allocation of risk and the allocation of benefits to those parties who want to take the risk.
Does your logic also apply if the spud date is before the notice, which looks like it happened in a couple of the eight wells?
On the sixth, exactly.
And then there's a question about whether it happened on nine.
Correct. It wasn't in evidence, but yes, was a question on that.
What wasn't in evidence?
On the number nine. There wasn't any evidence submitted by anybody on the number nine until the appellate stage.
As to the spud date?
Right. It was just put in the appellate briefing. But anyway, But for purposes of, let's just say two were, yes, I would say that it would pertain even if a well were spudded prior to the sending out of the notice. Once again, the party is still given their full opportunity of their 30-day election period. They have more information within which to make their decision. They benefit. There's no harm. And it's clearly a benefit to the other parties. Just keep in mind, the operator is the one that starts the operation. What the Court of Appeals is saying, if he starts early, he also knocks out the benefits to all the other consenting parties who have chosen to take the risk. It's not just the operator that loses out. And another construction or difficulty you have with the Court of Appeals construction is, say that the operator is not the proposing party. Say it's a non-operator, because anybody can propose the drilling of a well under an operating agreement. And say the non-operator does it. Well, say the operator doesn't want to consent to it. He still does the operation. He could purposely start the operation early to keep the proposing party from ever having any benefit of the non-consent provisions. I mean, there's a lot of problems that this Court of Appeals opinion raises. Is the court has probably seen in some of the materials that we filed, some of the commentators have already started raising these type of issues.
Let's assume that the language in the operating agreement did require, from your standpoint, an absolute adherence to the 30-day notice period. That notice period had to expire before there could be any commencement of operations. And those were strict. And the language of the operating agreement was such that you would agree that those were strict time periods. Would you still assert the same arguments and say, even if we violated those provisions, those time periods, and started operations early, for instance, that provided more information to the working interest owners, that still would be something that we should say was okay?
I'll answer that two ways. I would originally say no to that. We addressed that in our brief because the situation you've outlined is the New Mexico case that was cited. They had a specific agency order that said you cannot start operations until the 30-day period has expired. I mean, this agreement could have said that if that's what the party intended. It didn't. And in that case, they held you had to wait. They held you couldn't take advantage of the non-consent provisions because you didn't wait. Now, we did make an argument in our brief that it's still not a condition precedent and you'd have to show damages. But I would say that I think that the way the New Mexico court decided that is proper. I mean, if it expressly, clearly says that, like they did in the New Mexico Tenth Circuit case, that yes, I think you would be governed by that.
In that Mountain States case, did the court say why, or did the court explain the reasoning behind that requirement, strict adherence to the 30-day waiting period?
They really didn't. They were also, that case was an odd case because they were upset with the operator because they sent out notice and it never got responded to in any form or fashion. They felt the operator had an obligation to make sure the notice was received and they had an opportunity. So it was really one of those type of cases where they were really concerned the operator just didn't give any notice of anything to the party and give them an adequate opportunity to participate. But they didn't really discuss why the agency expressly worded it that way.
Is there any circumstance where there would be less than 30 days for the non-working owner to...
There is if there is a rig on location. I'm glad you brought up that point. The way the operating agreement works is, say you had proposed to drill a well. Everybody consents, you drill it. It's a dry hole. You want to deepen the well. If you've got a rig sitting on that well, then there's a 48-hour provision that applies, and you have to respond in 48 hours. That does not mean, and it is in the industry, that you can go out, contract a rig, put it on your location, and then say it's 48 hours. It's for a rig that's already on location for an operation that has been consented to, and you know, you're just going to do something additional while you've got the rig out there. So that's the purpose of that provision. So
going back to the Montana,
sure.
Montana case, if this language in the operating agreement in this case is properly interpreted as requiring strict adherence to the notice requirement, the 30-day notice requirement, then you lose.
Well, it depends on when you say that. I guess it depends when you say even strict adherence. This operating agreement does not say that you cannot commence operations until the expiration of the 30-day period.
I've posited that. If the language in the operating agreement is interpreted to say that, then you lose.
If the operating agreement was interpreted to say that.
You don't think it says that.
It doesn't say that. It clearly doesn't expressly say that. And to construe that, you would have to ignore industry custom and practice, completely throw it out. And I think you'd have to ignore the common definition of within, even to get there. I see my time is up.
Thank you. Court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Edwin Buckner will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Zabel, Mr. Morick. I think it's important that at the outset of this case that we acknowledge that what we're dealing with is the imposition of a penalty and the circumstances under which the penalty can be imposed. As I listen to counsel's argument, in the Court of Appeals, one could have the notion that they're saying Mrs. Dorsett's attempting to prohibit the drilling of a well, and she's not attempting to prohibit the drilling of a well. What Mrs. Dorsett seeks to do is to, in Justice Morris's words, require moderately strict adherence to the notice provisions as a prerequisite for imposition of the non-consent penalty. And that's what we're dealing with here. So when we hear all about, I will address the so-called usage customs and the industry customs, but when we hear about lack of rig availability and these other force majeure type arguments, we're talking about the imposition of a penalty. It's undisputed.
Let me ask you about that. I've seen the use of the term penalty and forfeiture in some of the case law. I haven't studied it closely yet, but I wonder, is that an appropriate term? That at the outset, the parties have an option to participate in a risk, correct?
Yes, sir.
There are costs to that risk.
Yes, sir.
There's an upside potentially to that risk. The parties that opt not to participate in the risk then have to wait on the sidelines while the parties who did participate in the risk put some of their monies, their assets on the line, get 300% of the proceeds, then the others get to jump back into the income stream. Why is that a penalty or forfeiture to compensate parties for opting to undertake a risk at the expense of parties who did not or decided not to risk their assets?
Well, in this case, Mrs. Dorsett says that she didn't receive the requisite notice and the timeline wasn't complied with, if that's what you're asking.
Well, let's put the notice issue to the side. Why is just compensating folks who participated in a risk 300% before the others get to participate in the income stream, why is that a penalty?
Well, it says it's a penalty in the operating agreement, and I guess you could phrase it in a different way and say it's a extra compensation for putting up the money, for taking the risk. I'm not sure if you're asking if there's a different terminology. A liquidated, the Court of Appeals says it's a liquidated damage clause. I suppose there could be different terminology. But my point is, in this case, because there were no the requisite notices weren't provided, Mrs. Dorsett and Valence operate the status of co-tenants, and the 300% penalty is out.
The petitioner says that if the clause means what the Court of Appeals said, and if starting work means what the Court of Appeals said, then as a practical matter, this clause is not going to be enforceable in many, many instances because of the exigencies of the oil field. What's your response to that?
My response is, first, there's no evidence of that. I mean, we just have these, not in the trial court, certainly, not in the Court of Appeals. And suddenly,
it's sort of intuitive, though, isn't it? I mean, whether we have evidence of it or not, can't we just intuit that would be the case?
I disagree, Your Honor. And I also want to say that, you know, as of today, we've never heard a reason such as an exigent circumstance as to why these eight notices weren't timely furnished. There wasn't an explanation in the trial court. There was an explanation in Texas County.
If she were seeking to assert an interest as opposed to avoid a penalty, do you think that the language should be interpreted differently?
I'm not sure I understand the question. She's asserting a co-tenant interest as opposed to a co-tenant interest burden with the 300% penalty, or
no? If the notice was given very late, 5 days before they finished, and it was clear at that point that it was going to be a gusher, and she says, "Oh, I want in on that," Judge O'Neill's asking, "Would you treat? I mean, would you just say, well, I'm sorry, the notice was late, you don't get any?"
Well, again, I assume that if she were afforded that information, certainly she would participate, in particular on wells 6 and 9 when they were drilled commenced drilling, actual spudding after the notice was given.
But you're saying the provision might operate differently if she were trying to take advantage. She wanted to participate and was trying to say her election was timely, as opposed to if she was resisting paying the 200% and was trying to say it was untimely.
I would assume that valence could not prevent her from participating in that case. But, Justice Heck, I did also want to we'll get back to evidence and that sort of thing.
Let me just go back. So you would treat it differently?
I would think that she would be able to come in late and participate. There's this notion that, well, she has this information that's invaluable to make a decision given the late notices. First, there's no evidence of that, and it didn't happen, in fact. So it's just not feasible. But valence wants to look at the non-consent penalty and say, well, there's a notice requirement, and we gave notice. It doesn't matter when we gave notice. But, in fact, the notice provision is very strict. And my words are it sets forth a timeline. Chief Justice Moore said it sets forth a chronological process.
Well, all she's entitled to under this, it looks like, reading it, is notice of the proposed work. And she got notice of the proposed work, whether they actually started or not. What more notice could she legitimately be entitled to under this document? And why wasn't that time? She had her 30 days to elect or not. What was tardy about that?
What was tardy about it is it specifically says that in order to be entitled to the benefits of this article, the party given the notice shall, within 60 days after the expiration of the 30-day notice period, commence work. That wasn't complied with. And again, what we're seeking is not to prevent the drilling of a well, not to prevent valence recouping 100% of Mrs. Dorsett's share of drilling, completion, and operational costs, but to prevent the imposition of a penalty.
I'm just questioning your use of the term. You keep saying she got late notice. That's really not your argument. Your argument is they drilled prematurely.
No, I disagree because I don't want to get in a situation. I think that plays into what Valence says. Valence says Mrs. Dorsett's attempting to prevent the drilling.
What notice did she get that was untimely?
Every notice. Every one of the eight wells.
Why was it untimely?
Because they had commenced operations on 7 of the 8 wells at the time she received notice.
But that has nothing to do with notice. It has to do with when they drilled it back.
No, it does, Your Honor. It has to do with whether the imposition of the penalty is permitted. If as to when the notice was received and when the operations commenced. And on 2 of the wells, the well was actually drilling at the time she received the notice.
Is that in evidence?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. It certainly is. The number 9 well was addressed, and it's in the record. It was addressed in a motion for preliminary injunction that's in the file. And it's also not challenged by valence.
Is it in the summary judgment record?
No, Your Honor, it was after the summary. Well, I take that back. I believe it is in the summary judgment record.
And she's harmed by not getting notice until some work has started how?
Why is Mrs. Dorsett harmed? Well, counsel alluded to one reason Justice Morris cited, and that was that she would have, if the notice provision was complied with, she would have an election at the 30th day as to whether to pick up other non-consenting interest owners or whether to maintain her share. The other reasons I believe she was harmed, and I do want to say I don't think she has to prove that she's harmed to.
So she waits to see what everybody else is going to do?
Yes.
And everybody else also waits to see what everybody else is going to do. So, in fact, you can't wait to see what everybody else is going to do since everybody's going to do it on the last minute.
I don't know if that's true, but that was what Justice Morris said. And my position is she doesn't have to prove harm to rely upon the contractual language for imposition of penalty, but she is harmed in that there's when you sign up to participate in a well as a working interest owner, you advance your drilling cost after the well is drilled, if the well is deemed capable of producing oil and gas in commercial quantities, you advance your completion cost. And the way the operating agreement is set up with the notice language and the 60 days commencement of work after the notice period expires, she staggers her payments. She puts up her drilling cost. 6, 8, 10 weeks elapse, she puts up her completion cost. And that gives a person such as Mrs. Dorsett an opportunity to raise funds, to cash in investments, to come up with the money over a period of time, rather than coming up with the money in a compressed period of time when the notice is not given. And typically, her interest was 4%. These were million-dollar wells, so she would have $20,000 due at the time of drilling the well or election to participate, and $20,000 due 6, 8, 10 weeks later.
That's
at the time
your
of
speculation.
Completion.
I mean, conceivably, the well could be drilled in 5 days. After, I mean, she, all it really gives her is 30 days to get her money together, because conceivably, the well could be spent at the 31st day, the 32nd day, completed in 2 or 3 days. I mean,
this was a 10,000-foot well.
But that's, we're talking contractually. That's not going to be the case.
But practically,
and if it was a situation where they've got the rig on location, she's only got 48 hours. So
that's true.
From the factual standpoint, the most she could get was 30 days to get capital.
I agree with you that if it was a very shallow well, that the time period would be compressed. And I agree with you that the 48-hour period, if Valence had utilized that, that would push her to her election sooner. But that wasn't done in this case.
I'm just saying from a contractual construction standpoint, not well by well.
Well, I guess the practical effect is that she had her financial obligations compressed on her rather than spread out over this Cotton Valley venture.
But she could have consented and avoided the imposition of this penalty. And what about the notice problem prevented her from doing that? I mean, there's sort of a disconnect there.
Well, the disconnect is she doesn't believe the notice provisions were complied with.
But
well, she got the certified mail. I mean, when you say no question, she got a notice.
No question about that.
And no question, she had 30 days after receipt of the notice within which to notify the parties whether she elected to participate. She had that.
No question about that.
So you're just, whenever you say she didn't get notice, you mean, well,
timely notice.
Because they only because they started work before.
Well, if you go down to paragraph 2, it clearly says, in order to be entitled to the benefits of this article, meaning the 300% non-consent penalty, the operator must, within 60 days after the expiration of the 30-day notice period, commence work. And it's very specific. It says, in order to be entitled to the benefits of the non-consent penalty, this is what the operator must do.
The Court of Appeals misquoted Article 6b-2, the relevant provision here, at page 235. You're familiar with that, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that determinative of the Court of Appeals' outcome, that they quoted the language correctly, interpreted the correct language in that part of the opinion? Does that make a difference, or do you contend that the language they quoted compared to the actual language in the operating agreement in substance mean the same?
I don't see a really substantial difference, Your Honor. The other way I believe Mrs. Dorsett is harmed by not getting the notice properly is that she has, and I have the Court of Appeals cited a law review article saying that not only with proper notice does an investor have a time to reflect financially on the venture, but also geologically on the venture as to whether it makes sense to her. And this is a 677-acre unit. For example, the number 9, at the time the number 9 was drilled, there were 8 wells in the unit, 8 Cotton Valley wells, approximately 60 acres per well. Mrs. Dorsett may have very well have said if she had received notice of the number 9. I think there's enough Cotton Valley wells in this unit. There's 80-acre spacing. That's been complied with. I want to drill a well, but I would like to see a well drilled to a different formation, a shallow formation, for example. And that would be difficult to propose or suggest once the well's already at 7,500 feet when she received the notice. I'll just touch briefly on the commencement of work or commencement of operations, which Valence has challenged. They don't like the citation of the lease perpetuation cases by the Court of Appeals. No explanation is ever given for quarreling with those citations. Valence repeatedly uses the term spud. The actual bit going into the ground, the agreement does not say spud. It says commencement of work or commencement of operations. I also want to address the so-called industry usage or industry custom. The Valence and the amicus curiae parties have said that if moderately strict adherence to the notice requirements is imposed or utilized for imposition of the penalty, then it will disrupt oil and gas operations, it will delay oil and gas operations, and even today we heard that there may be a situation where a lease is about to expire. I can't see that happening. Again, we're talking about imposition of a penalty. An operator is not going to delay operations. It's not going to disrupt operations. And an operator is certainly not going to let a valuable lease expire because they can't impose a penalty as a result of their own refusal or failure to provide timely notice. Finally, it was alluded to by Justice Ross, and it's alluded to in one of the periodicals submitted by the petitioner. The simple solution to this is to give notice. And there's no reason why notice couldn't have been given in this case. And we're asking that the court affirm the Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
If I could start where he kind of concluded, where counsel mentioned the Texoda and the Valence was indicating that custom and practice in the industry should prevent strict adherence to the joint operating agreement provisions. That's not what Valence is saying. It's not what Texoga said. The operating agreement does not provide you have to wait to start the operations. The notice provision says nothing whatsoever about that. What Texoga and Valence are saying is that whenever you have a model form that's used throughout an industry, the parties are in the industry, you have to construe it in accordance with industry custom and practices. The UCC, the restatement, both say those are read into every contract that's done between people in the same business. So we're not saying that you have that there's anything in the operating agreement that says that you can't start early. Their entire construction hinges on the word within. It never really comes out, but it all comes down to one word, the word within. They want to use the word within to mean that you have to do it only within that secret, magical 60-day period. But that's an unreasonable construction of the word within. It isn't the common definition if you look in Webster's, and it sure isn't what the industry custom and practice would dictate the definition of that word would be. One of the things I didn't get to address earlier was the Court of Appeals also had a problem with the word proposed operation, that it meant something in the future. If you just look to the wording of the operating agreement, in the provision they say, in order to be entitled to the benefits of this article, the operator must actually commence work within 60 days following expiration of the 30-day period and must complete it, that is, the proposed operation, with due diligence. The operating agreement itself contemplates that after you start it, the proposed operation is still proposed until you complete it, you finish it. It's the way the language reads. And proposed is really submitted for consideration in any event. But so even the Court of Appeals' conclusion as to what the word proposed means didn't have any real justifiable basis. I don't know whether I need to go back over the penalty. There's been a couple of appellate cases after the Hamilton case. The Hamilton case talked about it being a liquidated damages provision. The more current view of the courts is that it's just a risk allocation provision. It's not in the nature of a penalty. It's a bargained upon benefit that parties who take the risk, step up to the plate, consent, and pay their money get.
Does it matter in the analysis? I mean, if we considered it a liquidated damages clause, would we read it that same language differently as opposed to if she were asserting an interest?
I don't think it makes any difference, and that's why I was reluctant to even bring it up. I don't think it makes any difference whether it's a liquidated damages provision or whether it's just a risk allocation provision that's not considered to be a liquidated damages provision. I don't think it makes any difference in the context of this case. As far as the counsel in the case, we keep trying to interject this new evidence. If you look back at it, what happened was, you look at the trial record, there's no evidence that custom and practice by either party was submitted. But what happened is, when they get to the Court of Appeals, the respondent cites Professor Conine's law review article for what the purpose of the provision is, and the Court of Appeals latches onto that. Except the problem is, they took some of the statements that Mr. Conine made out of context. And although they took one provision where it says usually the election is afforded before operations commence, the Court of Appeals failed to read on. And it said you must elect. You absolutely must elect within the 30-day period. So they take one small part and they ignore. It appears that they decided the case based on their erroneous idea of what custom and practice in the industry was. If you look at the Nierberg case they relied on, supposedly, the Nierberg case says the very purpose of the notice provision is to require the parties to make a timely election whether they're going to be in or out. I mean, that's the very purpose of it. And what the Court of Appeals has done in this case is they frustrated the very purpose of the notice provision.
Were the circumstances that you argued here regarding the practice of the industry called to the attention of the Court of Appeals?
The Court of Appeals, I believe, did have the benefit of those. I'm not certain whether they got until the motion for rehearing from Valence, but they did have an opportunity to look at those. Unfortunately, Texoga a lot of times only gets around to writing their briefs when it gets to the Supreme Court level. And I mean, if you're going to rely on custom and practice, who is more credible? I don't mean to disparage any law professors, but law professors typically don't work in the industry. Texoga is out drilling wells every single day, and they're 90% of the industry. I think if you're going to look to custom and practice, it seems more credible to look to Texoga, who represents 90% of production, than does a single statement, I think, out of context in the law review article.
Thank you, counsel. Any further questions?
One other question.
Yes.
Theoretically, is it possible that a strict 30-day notice period could be beneficial, or on the other side of the coin, harmful, if the operators could, by the speed at which they start proposed operations, the type of information that you get from when they start those proposed operations, and they might be able to manipulate the amount of information that a working interest owner may get, if they, for instance, just theoretically, rush to the site and within 2 days after notice and start doing a lot of work, looks good, versus taking their time, not getting to the site to the 31st day, beginning drilling and things 31 days later, they seem to suggest that there's not as much excitement about the site. Is thinking of asking you about theoretical ways.
Sure.
I don't recall reading about any evidence of any of this in this case, but theoretically, is it possible to manipulate data so that a strict 30-day notice period is useful?
I think a lot of things are possible, but whether they're reasonable is the way I would really look at it. An operator almost always has a majority of interest, and if they don't, they still have their own interest. They are not going to undertake actions that are detrimental to their own interest. I mean, they wouldn't go try to make something look different than it is, because they'd be harming themselves as well as anyone else. So, I mean, I think, yeah, I mean, you can always come up with possibilities, but I guess, you know, I always try to focus on, would it be a realistic thing that would actually happen in the industry? And I guess I would answer that it would not.
Thank you, counsel. The call is submitted, and the court will take another brief recess.
All rise.